This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. Attorney General faces charges of contempt of Congress, but for the wrong reasons. A lesson on human rights and public education, and a petition to put President Obama and all the heads of NATO on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
But first, a talk with one of the people that started the Stop, Stop, and Frisk campaign in New York. It began with the End Mass Incarceration Network, organized by Carl Dix and Professor Cornel West and others last summer. Thousands took part in a silent march earlier this month, including lots of politicians that wanted to be seen as opposing stop and frisk. Carl Dick says it's important to stick with the message.
When we issued the call for this campaign for civil disobedience to stop, stop and frisk, we were setting out to change the way society viewed that policy from something that is necessary to keep crime down to what it really is, a racist, illegal policy that had to be stopped. And I think Sunday's march indicates that we have made a lot of progress in that direction, but it also poses new challenges because the fact that all those mayoral hopefuls felt like they had to put their face in that march behind a theme of end, stop, and frisk indicates that a lot of people have been moved to that position, and these politicians feel like if they don't put their face in the middle of it, they would lose political viability. The challenge, though, is to ensure that what does not happen at this point is that stop and frisk gets some surface reforms, some tweaks, while the essence of it, which is treating black and Latino youth like criminals, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. That's the essence of stop and frisk. We want to end the whole thing. We need to end the whole thing. Tweaks and surface reforms won't cut it. Stop and frisk has got to go.
One would be a little leery of politicians who might already have a compromise in their pocket.
Yeah, and some of the talk that they bring to it is that they can enact policy. But if the policy is a tweak to a racist, illegal policy, that is not good for anybody for it to be enacted, except for the powers that be who have been using stop and frisk as an application of the racial profiling that gives you a pipeline to mass incarceration and what I call a counterinsurgency that the capitalist system has launched in advance of an insurgency from among the people that it holds on the bottom of society, because they remember the 1960s. They remember the role that black youth played in spearheading mass revolutionary movement that rocked the system back on its heels, and they want to head that off this time. That's why they're moving the way that they are with policies like stop and frisk, racial profiling across the board, and that's why I, as a revolutionary, saw the need to target that and to fashion an approach that could draw broad support and involvement, which is what we're working on now to see to it that this movement goes forward and doesn't get sidetracked by politicians, preachers, or whoever else might want to lead it into some sit-down and negotiation with a mayor and a police chief.
And that is the danger, that somehow stop and frisk gets separated from the overarching issue of mass black incarceration.
Yes, that's it, because when we targeted stop and frisk, when we sat down and decided how to move on this, we were coming from racially targeted mass incarceration as an overarching problem, a concentration of the oppression of black people. And that's something that I see as a slow genocide targeting black people. And you can't deal with a slow genocide by tweaking it, by making some surface reforms. You have to hit it hard and you have to stop it. And that's what we're aiming to do. And as part of that, some of the people who were part of the civil disobedience campaign, one trial has already ended. That was a trial in Manhattan. people got convicted, but they got time served. We have two more trials coming up, one in Brooklyn, one in Queens, and we are building a defense committee around the stop, stop, and frisk protesters. We're issuing the call to drop the charges on the protesters because they did nothing criminal. Stop and frisk is what's criminal. So that's what we're moving on, and we want to build a broad effort around that. We have a resolution that we have authored that we are circulating to union groups, student groups, community groups. We're going to church groups, and we've been going to some of those politicians who tried to get up front in the end stop and frisk march to say, are you serious or not? Because we're going to put the call on them and see how they fall out.
And if they're not serious, I guess you're going to name names.
Oh, yeah, we're going to name some names. We're going to say where people fall out by trying to make this a question that all of those people who want to see stop and frisk ended, we want to involve them in fighting to do that. And this is a way that they could actually get involved, continue to spread the word, and to bring out that stop and frisk is what is criminal and that it needs to be gotten rid of and that people who protest it should not be facing trial and jail time. In fact, they should be given medals for doing service to the community.
I know that some people felt constrained by the silent nature of the march. Did you?
Well, it is not what I would have done. I have been a part of calling for some actions around stop and frisk. They have been loud. They have been rowdy. And a number of times people have gotten arrested at them. So I would not have called a silent march. At the same time, when you would do something that you're trying to get broader and broader forces involved in, they're not going to do what you do. So I don't have a quibble with them calling a silent march as long as it's a silent march to end stop and frisk and that they move forward on that tip. That's my thing on it. At the same time, I don't have no beef with the people who at the end of the march broke the silence either, because I understand exactly where they were coming from. And sometimes you got to be loud to be heard. People who want to get a hold of the resolution calling for the dropping of the charges on the stop, stop, and frisk protesters can go to the website www.stopmassincarceration.net, and they can find information on our Bear Witness Against Abusive Policing project as well, which we're going to be going forward with in the summer, because the NYPD and the mayor's office are holding press events to try to convince the media that stop and frisk is not as bad as we say. Well, we're going to bring people who have been stopped and frisked, and people can check them out and see what they have to say about what happened to them, and then decide for themselves whether this is a good policy or racial profiling that targets and criminalizes Black and Latino youth.
That was Carl Dix of Stop, Stop, and Frisk in New York City.
Attorney General Eric Holder faces a charge of contempt of Congress stemming from a scheme in which the U.S. government wound up shipping weapons to Mexican drug lords. But many progressives see little reason to defend an attorney general who, along with his president, has sought to nullify much of the Bill of Rights. We spoke with David Swanson, peace activist and publisher of the influential website War is a Crime.
I don't think we have to or should defend abuses of power by this attorney general or this president any more than we did the previous ones. I think we can openly admit that this attorney general and this president are Black and that the Congress members going after them are a bunch of racists, just as we can admit that someone has accused Julian Assange of sexual assault, which we condemn without question, and yet acknowledge our responsibility to defend the human rights and the journalistic rights of Julian Assange and to condemn the abuses of power by Obama and Holder, which, by the way, aren't new, didn't just start and don't begin and end with the passing of guns to Mexican drug lords. I mean, this is a Congress that has sat by and said nothing while Eric Holder declared his right and the president's right to imprison people without charge forever and ever, to rendition them, to abuse them in any way, and to murder them by drone and otherwise. Not a peep out of this Congress. This is an administration that went to war in Libya explicitly in defiance of the will of this Congress, and, you know, not a bit of concern out of them. And, of course, it's a bunch of partisan hypocrisy, because these are, in most cases, Republicans who didn't care about these kinds of abuses when Bush and Cheney were in office. And for the most part, Democrats, who now have no concern about them at all, who wanted Bush and Cheney strung up for the same types of abuses, which is, of course, why the public is so turned off by both of these parties.
Of course, the administration is claiming some form of executive privilege. We know that executive privilege can be used to hide mountains of crimes.
Well, there is no executive privilege in the Constitution or in international law or in our laws. Executive privilege is an invention of executives who were supposed to be weak and execute the will of Congress, which is largely what's held this nation together as long as it's lasted under this form of government. And we ought to be condemning the very idea of executive privilege. An executive ought to be someone who executes the will of our legitimately elected representatives in Congress, which, of course, we don't have at the moment, but that's the theory, that's the goal or the ideal. And you have a president who has been making law by executive order, a president who's been claiming state secrets powers in courts to shut down cases to protect himself and his predecessors and their corporate allies, far and away beyond anything that Bush or Cheney ever tried. To their credit, you have a handful of Congress members, bipartisan group led by Congressman Gerald Nadler, who have reintroduced their bill, which looks destined to go nowhere, to give courts control over state secrets claims asserted by presidents. That's the right kind of step to be taking. But to simply be holding an attorney general in contempt yet again on partisan lines seems to me to degrade the idea of congressional authority. When Bush and Cheney were in town, you had subpoenas, not to mention requests for appearances and documents, blatantly refused by the vice president, by the attorney general, by the White House political director, the White House Office of Management and Budget, and so forth, a long list of refused subpoenas. Condoleezza Rice said she wasn't inclined to show up or comply. The vice president asserted that he just wouldn't comply with any subpoenas before he got any, and he didn't. And you had Congress in several cases hold those people in contempt, as of course most of us ordinary people hold the whole lot of them in contempt. But they haven't in recent decades literally held anyone in contempt. In decades gone by, Congress used to hold people in prison cells on Capitol Hill until they testified to the satisfaction of the Congress. And they considered this a self-preservation technique. It was the inherent right of the institution of Congress to literally hold people until they ceased to be in contempt. And they don't do that anymore. And so you saw the Democrats subpoena the Justice Department under Bush and ask the Justice Department to enforce those subpoenas and hold itself in contempt, which of course didn't work out. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the Republicans are so accommodating, whether they ask Holder to hold himself in contempt, to enforce the subpoenas against himself. John Conyers, as you know, went so far as to sue in court rather than actually assert power by Congress, which could come in two obvious conceivable forms, one of which would be to actually use the power of inherent contempt and arrest people. The other would be to impeach. I would have very mixed feelings about seeing a move to impeach Holder or Obama by this gang that will want to impeach them for all the wrong reasons. But were Congress willing and interested in asserting the power of Congress and the responsibility to represent majority will and to enforce laws against powerful people, then it would start enforcing subpoenas outstanding against both Republicans and Democrats from the past 12 years or so. And it would begin impeaching people, both those still in office and those out of office, and those having been put in wrongful office as reward for their crimes, such as Jay Bibee, who has a lifetime appointment as a federal judge for having authored torture memos. Were we to see that kind of nonpartisan assertion of power, you would also see Congress's ranking in the polls and approval in the polls begin to climb out of the record low single digits where it's fallen.
One thing is clear, and that is the behavior of the executive branch has shown itself to be bipartisan, in that this administration behaves very much like the previous administration.
Right. And when we were trying to impeach Bush and Cheney, and everyone was screaming at us, oh, you just don't like his accent and his bad grammar, and you think he's stupid, and you don't like Republicans. And, you know, we said, no, listen, if you let these guys get away with this, the next guys, men, women, Republicans, Democrats, will do the very same thing and get away with it more easily and move beyond. And that's exactly what's happened. So these abuses that were somewhat illicit and scandalous, of locking people up without charge, of spying without warrant, of rendition and torture and assassination, these have now become open, formal policy put down in executive order and put down in congressional legislation, with a great deal of complicity by the Republicans in Congress, who want to viciously attack Obama and at the same time are delighted to give him and future presidents, who they hope will be Republicans, the power to engage in all of these abuses, which once this has been accepted under both Bush and Obama, the Supreme Court will treat as powers of the presidency. And it will be virtually impossible, come the next president of whichever party, to undo these changes to the power of what we still misleadingly call an executive and what we ought to call a king.
And we in many ways have crossed that Rubicon already.
We have. We are at the point where you have not just Democratic lawyers like Harold Coe, who condemned all of this when it was Republican and now defend it, but ordinary people who give their loyalty to the Democratic Party supporting the very things that they protested when Bush was president, even understanding that there may be a Republican president coming down the road and then they will be upset at having given all of these powers away. It will be too late. And the answer, of course, is not just to elect a good Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson president with absolute power. The answer is the one thing that the wealthy slave-owning sexists who put this country together got right, that we've set aside, which is that you can't give absolute power to an individual and not have them corrupted. You have to check and restrain power. And we have ignored that wisdom and given presidents, the current one and everybody who comes after him, more power than King George III ever had. In a couple weeks, we'll have another July 4th, and we'll remember the Declaration of Independence and the list of grievances against the king. And if that dictator had a list of people he was going to kill, a secret list of who he would murder with no accountability to anyone, that abuse would have been number one in the list of complaints in the Declaration of Independence. But King George III didn't do anything that bad, so it wasn't in there. We have gone beyond what they fought a war against.
David Swanson, publisher of the website War is a Crime and author of the book War is a Lie.
This summer we'll see the establishment of a community freedom school named after the great singer and social activist Paul Robeson in Brooklyn, New York. It's a project of the Coalition for Public Education, which opposes the imposition of charter school. Coalition organizer Rodney Dees says public education in New York is being deliberately disrupted by destructive policies.
Privatization, underfunding the schools, closing, phasing out of the schools, put in these new privately ran schools. They take the public money and put it into private hands, and it underfunds the schools so the students don't have the proper tools that they need to excel in school. They're closing schools at a rapid breakneck speed. what we're doing is bringing awareness. The Paul Robeson Freedom School is just an example of what communities are starting to realize that they must do, because this privatization movement is well-financed. They don't care how destructive. It's all about money. It's business-driven. It's a business model, and they're looking at numbers, not people, human beings. So we created this community school. Of course, you know the history. Most of your audience are well-informed audience that you have. They know the history of freedom schools and where that kind of came about. So right here in New York City on July 9th, we're going to be opening an 8-week pilot program during the summer months from July 9th to August 24th. And we'll be educating the students for liberation. Do go to our website, paulrobesonfreedomschool.org.
It sounds very much like this new Freedom School is as much a creation of the students that you've been organizing at the existing Paul Robeson School.
You got your finger on it, brother. The students have chosen the curriculum. And I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but it will be student involved big time. And, of course, their parents. And some of these students are homeless. This school that we're in, brother, 13% of the students there are homeless.
That was Rodney Dees of the Coalition for Public Education in Brooklyn.
Also in New York City, the Independent Commission on Public Education, or ICOPE, has called for a human rights-based school system. Ellen Rader is active with ICOPE. She has a history in conflict resolution and holds a master's degree in educational psychology. Rader says the human rights of students, parents, and whole communities are often violated through oppressive educational policies.
For example, there's a human right to the full development of each child to their fullest potential. But when you have the kind of dropout rates that we have, we know that whole bunches of young people are leaving the public school system no way fulfilling their human potential. Another important human right is that parents and communities and students must participate in all aspects and all decisions that affect their right to education. Under mayoral control in New York City over the past 10 years, it's gotten worse and worse, and parents and students are not in the decision-making loop in any meaningful way. Human rights also preserves the dignity of all students in school. With arrests and suspensions and push-outs and bullying, all the things that happen in schools that are not handled well are a violation of human rights. And because there are no encoded law, this is not being measured by an oversight group. It just happens on a regular basis, and it's the norm. It's the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander says. It's just the way school is, because people don't claim the rights, and government doesn't fulfill the rights.
So one human right is the right to have community control of education.
One of the human rights in our booklet that we talk about, communities have a right to development. And schools could be an anti-poverty program. Schools in their vending could be buying local in their community, like they do in Cleveland, Ohio. There are two anchor institutions, the hospital and the university, and they have pledged to buy from worker-owned collaboratives in the Cleveland city. That keeps the money circulating locally and keeps the city developing. So if we had a different procurement policy, if we had a different hiring policy, education in and of itself, the school system, could really help communities develop. And community control is another way of saying parents and students must have decision-making processes at the school and district level. So there's two ways of looking at how control of the schools, control of the pedagogy, the curriculum, the hiring of Black and Latino teachers, the vending in the local community, rather than letting the money go to the top 1%. In New York City, for example, there were bookstores, Black own bookstores that were vendors to the Board of Education. The mayor came along and arbitrarily said you had to have $5 million worth of revenue in order to be a vendor to the school system. So that takes care of the top 1% companies, but it doesn't allow a minority-owned bookstore to function. So it went out of business.
So you see education as an engine of community development, but of course others, and they seem to be in the catbird seat, say that schools should be run like a business, the business model of education.
Well, there's nothing wrong with having good financial oversight of public money. That's a necessity in a public school system. But the decisions about, quote, efficiency and economy of scale and all that kind of stuff that says, okay, let's purchase for an entire system, that may be good for the 1% vendors, but it's not good for community development. So the rights of the community, in my opinion, trump the rights of the billionaires.
There is, of course, this theory that schools should turn out students with the skills that businesses want. That's the primary job of a school, to serve the needs of businesses.
Well, that violates human rights, because human rights says the purpose of education is the full development of each individual child, intellectually, artistically, physically, as a civic player, as a person who, a lifelong learner. Of course, having a good job at a living wage is also part of education, but it is not the prime driver. And every time I hear politicians and presidents talk about we're going to be economically under the gun because of other developing nations because our kids are not graduating with business skills, I mean, that's part of it, but our democracy is falling apart. So for me, the definition, the purpose of education is to fulfill democracy. And another part, of course, is a good job, but it is not the prime driver.
In New York and in almost all other cities where charter schools are being pushed, we see that a strong mayoral control of the educational system is the norm.
Mayoral control is violating human rights because, at least in New York City, the public has been pushed out of decision-making and parents and students are not involved in decision-making. So that's a violation of human rights. There is no strong grievance mechanism. There's nobody to talk to. You don't know how to talk to a system. The system itself talks about accountability, but the mayor is not accountable to anyone. He says you can boo him if you don't like him at parades, but you virtually can't get rid of him if you don't like policies, and he controls the decision-making body, which is called the PEP, the Panel for Educational Priorities. So he's virtually a dictator, and that's a violation of many human rights. The model doesn't work. The activist parents and students in the city have gone to these PEP meetings to protest his policies on many occasions. There's long, long meetings. They do not listen. So this mayoral control is anti-human rights, anti-democratic. And if it was working, maybe you could look at it. But it's not even working. His test scores are virtually flat. The original notion of a charter school was to have some experimental stuff going on so teachers and parents and students could create pockets of innovation that would be brought back into the school system. What you have now is a privatizing of the school system, not an experiment of the school system. And what's interesting is the latest studies that show that only 17% of the charter schools do better, 37% actually do worse, and 46% do about the same. So they're not doing any much better. They may look better in that they have bells and whistles, but this is a very interesting phenomena, and the charter schools are used as a wedge to separate parents from other parents in Black and Latino communities because the public schools have been starved and it looks nice to see new technology and new whiteboards in schools, and the charter schools look better, and the PR that they can do in the city is all three-color mailings to parents, which they can do because they get all this money from the hedge funds. But the education isn't better, and what's sad to me is parents are buying in or falling prey to this. Many parents that I know who have started in charters have pulled out when they realize that there is no parent association in the charter, that they can't change anything because they have to deal with a private company that runs the school, a private board.
Why are hedge funds and other Wall Street interests so interested in and investing in charter schools?
I believe it's because they're making money. There's all kinds of ways to make money. There's an enormous budget that is public schools, and the billionaires and the hedge fund folks just want that money in their own hands.
In fact, it's a market approaching $1 trillion, public education as a whole.
Yeah. These hedge fund folks want to privatize the prisons, want to keep the privatized health care instead of having a public option. It's a neoliberal trend to privatize the world, to privatize water, to privatize prisons, to privatize schools.
As part of this charterization process, we see what looks like an all-out push to deprofessionalize teachers.
Absolutely. These organizations like Teach for America put teachers into schools after 5 weeks of training, instead of realizing that the profession needs more and more coaching, more capacity building. The school systems that are really doing well concentrate on capacity building. New York allows Teach for America to staff the lowest performing schools. I mean, the young people that come into these programs are interesting, dedicated kids, some of whom are really interested in teaching. But when my granddaughter asked, should she go into the program, I told her she would be learning more from the kids she's teaching than she could ever give the kids. And the majority of those folks come into the system and leave within a couple years. So it is not a solution. I'd rather build up community folks that come in as paraprofessionals or aides and get credit to go to college so that they can become teachers in their own neighborhood.
And once you get rid of the professional ranks of teachers, you can't easily replace them.
That's right. A lot of very good teachers have left the system. A lot of very good principals have left the system. Their major complaint is they can't teach anymore because everything is done to the test. And as soon as the test is finished, people in the schools relax because nothing else happens for a month or two after the testing. This high-stakes testing regime is harmful for children. It's harmful for learning. It does not fulfill the human right for the full development of each child. It narrows the curriculum. It's really bad news, and the problem is New York is seen as some kind of model, and so has Chicago with Arne Duncan, and then we have Duncan and Obama at the top of this system giving out incentives for people who raise the caps on charter schools and go along with this high-stakes testing regime. The federal government is complicit in violating the human rights of the children.
Ellen Rader of the Independent Commission on Public Education.
The International League of People's Struggle, with member organizations around the world, got a new chapter last month. The new U.S. chapter includes 28 organizations. We ask Bill Doors to explain the benefits of being part of a global organization.
It puts the movement in the United States to be part of a world movement, to be part of an international formation that's fighting against imperialism and monopoly capitalism, and that's necessary. And that's never been more necessary. It also brings the issue of international consciousness to be part of an international formation. The ruling class is always trying to pit, quote, Americans against the rest of the world. The question that we are part of a world movement is vital, I think, to the consciousness of people in this country who are in struggle.
It's often been said that the United States at various times has had an anti-war movement, but it very seldom has an anti-imperial movement.
That's true. And we cannot succeed either as an anti-war movement or as a movement against injustice in this country without being united with our sisters and brothers around the world, without being united for the majority of humanity. That is the thing that the ruling class in this country fears the most. That's why they hated Malcolm X when he said that black people in this country are not a minority, but a part of a global majority. They hate and fear internationalism and international identity, and like a vampire allegedly fears a cross in East European mythology. And when you see the thing that frightens them the most, that's the weapon that you need to use. We have member organizations in Australia and in the Philippines and Indonesia, in Kenya, in Senegal, in Europe and Latin America, to be able to work together in a coordinated way. We're fighting a global war. The war in Afghanistan, and the United States has cobbled together this, quote, coalition, where they have troops from around the world fighting as their mercenaries. So it should be important to make opposition international as well. Their wealth, their power, comes from plundering the entire globe. And we have to amass the weight of the world of working class and oppressed people and all those whose interests are opposed to imperialism around the world on the other side. And I think the founding of the U.S. country chapter is not the only thing. There are certainly other international formations and networks and alliances, but the founding of the U.S. country chapter of the League, the International League of People Struggle, which is specifically focused on with whatever differences we have among us on opposing imperialism. And it brings together labor organizations and student organizations and peasant organizations and ecological groups and women's organizations and lesbian, gay, bi, transgender organizations, all of whom see their common interests as the largest obstacle, the largest source of oppression in the world today is imperialism.
From your observations, how has being connected with a group that is international in scope contributed to the political education of its American members?
Well, that's, I think, the most important thing for us here in the United States, to be aware that we are part of one global class, one global force. The interests of the majority of people in the United States are best served by seeing ourselves in an international perspective and not as so-called Americans against the rest of the world, which only serves the interests of those Americans with names like Rockefeller and DuPont and Morgan, who are stealing our homes and stealing our jobs and then saying our enemy is somewhere else.
Bill Dorse of the International League of People Struggle.
There's yet more evidence that Rwanda has been fueling chaos and mass killings in neighboring Congo, where 6 million people have died since 1996. United Nations reports and a mounting body of evidence show that U.S. allies Rwanda and Uganda have been deeply involved in the worst genocide since World War II. Bahati Jox is a policy analyst for the Africa Faith and Justice Network, based in Washington, D.C. He says, yes, Rwanda has contributed to the bloodbath in Congo, but the Congolese government is also part of the problem.
Rwanda has a very good army, and that is what makes it a threat to Congolese security. And that what they use to continue to destabilize Congo. If Congo had a government efficient and patriotic, they could set up a strong army to secure its borders, and Rwanda would never be a threat to Congo. Congolese government should put in place mechanisms to contain those refugees who are into Congo, who Rwanda considers a threat, and then give them their rights as refugees on the Congolese territory, and prevent them from not only harassing the Congolese people, raping Congolese women, but welcome them as refugees with their own rights under international law, and then they should be able to go home when conditions are ready and appropriate in their home country.
If the United States really wanted to see peace and security in the Eastern Congo, since it has such close relationships with Rwanda and backs the government of Congolese President Kabila, one would think the United States could effectuate such a peace.
Unfortunately, from our understanding, none of the solutions that are put at the table as of now by the Congolese government, by the international community, including the U.S., are not Congolese people-centered. They are all to serve the international community purposes. Why is it hunting down one man, Bosco Ntaganda, a central issue to the international community. When we say the students cannot go to school anymore, people are running away for their lives. And what about reconciliation? What about reconciliation? Today we have news that the U.S. is talking with the Taliban. Why not the Congolese people speak with those who committed crimes against the citizens and also find a way for reconciliation and use African mechanisms of justice to get to the bottom of this problem and end it once and for all? Why is it that we have to dance to the tune of the international community, sometimes leading nowhere but perpetuating more problems?
So you're talking about a process that is outside of the mechanisms of the International Criminal Court, outside of the United Nations, outside of moderating by the United States or Europe.
It's a mechanism outside of all these special interests, a mechanism led by the people themselves. If those foreign powers want to participate and support, they are welcome. But I do believe that they are not serving the Congolese people when they focus on the ICC or just deploying United Nations peacekeepers doing almost nothing and being paid big money. That is nonsense and has to stop.
There are 20,000 United Nations peacekeepers in the Congo. They are of no use.
If you do a full report, what have they done? The results are very clear. The war is going on as we speak. Therefore, their presence has been nothing else than a failure. We have to change the way and the understanding of the issue.
Does this reconciliation process presuppose that the Congolese government gained control over its own territory?
The Congolese government must gain control of the territory. There should not be any place that is not governed by the government. But the question is who? The current leader we have is not able to bring people together and say, this is a state, this is our home, this is your home, this is your state, and you are a stakeholder. But the current regime believes that he and his close allies are the only stakeholder into Congolese affairs. And therefore, we have what we have. In America, every citizen feels like they are stakeholders. But America has failed to really stick to those values when it comes to Congo, when it comes to other places elsewhere. We want democracy the same way the American people want it and practice it. Why can't we implement it and support it? That is the question. So those mechanisms should involve the Congolese government, but as of now, I don't think Kinshasa can resolve the issues in the East because they are too far and have been far away, and they only react to the issues in the East to accommodate their own power and their desire to stay in power.
Jacques Bahadi of the Africa Faith and Justice Network in Washington.
An international delegation of black people is demanding that NATO and its heads of state, including President Obama, be charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. Human rights attorney Roger Wareham explains.
A group of black folks from across the African diaspora who self-styled themselves the Pan-African Solidarity Hague Committee took a petition to the International Criminal Court charging the NATO powers, the United States, Britain, Canada, France, Italy, Spain, Belgium, with war crimes and crimes against humanity for the acts they committed, in particular around the bombing of Libya and the murder of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the assault in Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, that resulted in the bombing of the presidential palace and the capture of President Laurent Gbagbo, the coup d'etat against President Aristide of Haiti in 2004, and the other part we looked at was the question of the targeting and persecution of black people in the United States, which has gone on forever. this whole campaign really began a year ago on Malcolm's birthday, May 19th, organization, one of the organizing organizations of the December 12th movement, always has a shutdown of 125th Street to observe Malcolm's birthday. And that evening, there was a program, and some different organizations attended the program, the Nation of Islam, CMOTAP, WADU, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and agreed that we needed to take a stand against what was clearly an attempt to effect regime change in Libya, which really had nothing to do with purported human rights violations, but had everything to do with a political and economic agenda that was being put forward by the Western powers to recolonize Africa and African people. And so from that May 19th meeting, there was a call for a national rally called Millions March in Harlem that was actually held on August 13th of 2011. Minister Farrakhan was the keynote speaker, and it addressed the issue of what was happening in Libya, what was happening in Cote d'Ivoire, what was happening in Haiti, what was happening in Zimbabwe, and what was happening to black folks in the U.S. From that, there was then a call to take this ongoing campaign, to put it in the context of going to the International Criminal Court, since it was clear that the International Criminal Court, on its own initiative, was not going to do anything around these war crimes that were being committed. So we held an International People's Tribunal at Columbia University Law School on January 14th of this year, where the prosecutors presented information to the judges. The judges were attorneys Lennox Hines, Stevens Hines and White, based in New York, who's been counsel for the ANC, has been a regular participant in the International War Tribunal around Rwanda. The other judge was David Kamachong of Barbados. He's an attorney in Barbados. Is a founding member and president of the Clement Paine Movement and of the People's Empowerment Party, and was a very prominent member of the Barbadian delegation to the World Conference Against Racism in 2001, and was an instrumental person in having that conference come out with a declaration that the transatlantic slave trade and slavery was a crime against humanity and that reparations were due. Our third judge is Rosemary Mealy, who's an attorney in New York City and has done a lot of work around Cuba. And so they heard the presentations that were made, the evidence that was produced, found that there was a prima facie case made of these crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. And so the next logical step was that we now take this evidence to the International Criminal Court and request that under their statute, that if the prosecutor is presented with evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity being committed, there's a reasonable basis from the evidence that's been given to him or her that he can initiate an investigation. That's what we did. We had no illusions that the International Criminal Court is going to take our evidence, which is rock solid, and then come with indictments against the United States, heads of state, or Britain, or Canada, or Belgium. But what we want to do is expose to our people the fact that the International Criminal Court, which was set up ostensibly to be a neutral court and to bring war crimes violators and crimes of humanity violators to trial, only functions against Africans. That of the 26 cases that are before the International Criminal Court, they all involve Africans. It is like the question of war crimes and violators of human rights ends outside the African continent. And it's not simply enough for us to tell people that, to understand that this has become a tool for the West to recolonize Africa. We have to show them that, and this campaign is part of that process in terms of they've got the evidence. We took it there on Monday. We tried to meet with the chief prosecutor. David Kamachong and I went into the ICC. We tried to meet with the chief prosecutor, who is now an African woman. She had just, Monday was her first day of work, Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia. She's the new chief prosecutor. She's been the deputy chief prosecutor for the past 10 years. But she declined to meet with us. But we gave them our communication. They have to get back to us. We told them that we're going to supplement it because there's continually more and more information. In Libya, we focus on the question of NATO really acting as the air force for the rebels, taking part in what, in essence, was a civil war. And although its mandate was to destroy the Air Force and provide air cover, they destroyed the Air Force, the Libyan Air Force, within 5 days in the middle of March. And thereafter that, they were basically acting as an air force for the rebels. And the rebels were and are a very diverse and motley group. But one of the things that is very clear that they're involved in is genocide against black Libyans. And that's one of the points we make in the communications, that in June of last year, the Wall Street Journal had an article talking about how a town of black Libyans called Tawaga had been destroyed by one of the rebel groups. The people had been dispersed. They had changed the name. They were literally trying to wipe out the fact that this town had existed. And so even with that information, the NATO powers continue to provide logistical support, arms, air cover for the so-called National Transition Council. So that was one of the points that we make in there. Around Haiti, we raised the issue that President Aristide was overthrown because he refused to capitulate to structural adjustment. He made a demand that France not only had to pay reparations, he made a demand in 2004 that France had to repay Haiti the money that Haiti was extorted and forced to pay in reparations to France for attaining their freedom 200 years before. And so a combination of factors around his resistance to structural adjustment, his demand for restitution, and what they could see on the horizon, his demand for reparations, and of course the fact that the Western companies had found oil and other mineral deposits in Haiti, was what led to his overthrow. So we went there on Monday. We gave him the papers. We went after that. There were 27 of us who came from the U.S., the Caribbean, African continent, and Europe to the ICC. From there, we went to, there was a gathering of the Ivoirians in Europe, had a caravan and a camp that they had set up in The Hague, because that Monday, the 18th, was supposed to have been the beginning of the confirmation hearings on the charges that were being brought against President Laurent Gbagbo. And it had been postponed, but they had their rally anyway. And so we went there. There were around 3,000 people there. I spoke. Minister Akbar Muhammad of the Nation of Islam spoke. And David Commachon of the Clement Payne Movement spoke. And the reception that we got from the Ivoirians was just incredible. In terms of the Pan-African solidarity. So one of the campaigns that's going to come out of this thing, because June 18th is not an event unto itself, nor is it a finite date, that we see this as a continuing campaign to expose the ICC and to demand that there be a single standard of justice for human rights throughout the world, and that one of the things is going to be a campaign to free President Laurent Gbagbo, that both he and Gaddafi were targeted by the West because they were opposed to AFRICOM, because they were struggling, Gbagbo in particular, was struggling for the independence of Cote d'Ivoire from the French. Most of the, I don't know if your listening, viewing, reading audience realizes, but all of the Francophonie countries, the ones who were former colonies of France, their budget, all of their funds go into France's central bank. And from there, France doles it back out to them. And so one of the things that President Gbagbo was struggling for was that, no, we don't need to be tied to the French like this. We're an independent country. We're a sovereign country. And was struggling to put into effect all the things that would ensure the political and economic sovereignty of Cote d'Ivoire. So that was one of the reasons why he was targeted.
Most of the charges that are embodied in your petition, with the exception of U.S. policy towards African Americans, have to do with R2P, responsibility mm-hmm. to protect. It does appear that mm-hmm. humanitarian intervention, and that is the hallmark of the Obama doctrine, is actually a negation of international law.
It is. When we began this campaign, we had a press conference, and that one of the people who attended it was Father Miguel Descoto. And Father Miguel Descoto was the first foreign minister for Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. And then I think in 2008, he was the president of the General Assembly. And he came to New York to attend the press conference that we were having in preparation for the Millions March in Harlem. And he said that one of the things he learned, even to a greater extent when he was president of the General Assembly, that for the West, the only international law that they adhere to is the law of the jungle. the law of force. And so the R2P doctrine, the responsibility to protect doctrine, is something that is used to invoke a military intervention, but the first thing it's supposed to do is to see if something can be worked out between the sides. And so in the case of Libya, the African Union in April had put forward a ceasefire agreement that Colonel Gaddafi had agreed to, but the rebels refused to agree to it. And so they refused to agree to it, and they engaged in military activities, and the NATO forces backed them. So that the R2P, the responsibility to protect doctrine, has really been turned on its head and become a responsibility to invade doctrine for those countries whose resources that the West covets or whose political leadership they want to do away with.
If there is no concept of national sovereignty, a small country has no rights that a large country is bound to respect.
Exactly. That is your twist on the Dred Scott decision. Yes, that's exactly what happens. It's the manifest destiny being carried out on an international scale. It's globalization and imperialism are the same thing. And so we hope with this campaign to educate our community, to understand and to become very critical readers and viewers of the media, which is why the Black Agenda Report is important, because it presents the point of view on many issues that people are not going to get in terms of mainstream media or the New York Times or the International Herald Tribune or the certainly not the Daily News. We have to learn how to read in terms of what's not being said. And so this campaign is a political education campaign to help our community to understand more clearly what's going on so that as an educated, thinking person, they and we can make the type of critical decisions that are necessary for us to change the conditions that we face. But we're not going to be able to do that if our view of the world is completely skewed and determined by a press and media that is opposed to us. Then we'll be in a position of what Malcolm said of hating our friends and loving our enemies.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.